You're listening to Midlife Side Quest, the Over the Hill Gaming Podcast. Here's your host, John Wall.
It's January 9th, 2025, and welcome to another episode of Midlife Side Quest, the Over the Hill Video Game Podcast. My name is John Wall, and every week I bring you my video game impressions, the latest industry news, and tales of a Gen X geek delivered to you in 15 minutes or your next podcast is free. Thank you so much for tuning in today. On this episode, I'm going to be talking about The Exit 8, plus the first installment of my new retro segment, Time Capsule. But first, let's check out some of the week's gaming news. And according to GameFile's Stephen Totillo, Call of Duty games are ridiculously expensive to make. Fished out of some court filings that are related to a lawsuit against Activision was the fact that 2020's Call of Duty Black Ops Cold War cost $700 million to make. Let that sink in. Nearly three-quarters of $1 billion to make a Call of Duty game. That's over three times as much as it cost to make The Last of Us Part 2. Now, I mean, there's a lot more that goes into a Call of Duty game. You know, you've got the single player, the multiplayer, there's the various other modes, and usually like a year's worth of near constant updates and add-on content. And, you know, they are always at the top of the best-selling games list, so there's that. But still, yikes. There's been a lot of talk recently about the increasing cost of AAA game development and, you know, especially with all the recent layoffs. I think it's a complicated problem, and there's a lot that goes into it. I'm sure a lot of the money that they pour into this stream of updates constantly is to try and keep up with Fortnite, which just prints money and is able to release content at a ridiculous pace. But is that sustainable? And now that Call of Duty is an Xbox title and launches day one on Game Pass, is the increase in subscriber numbers and the money that they spend enough to offset the loss of those retail sales on the Xbox? I don't know. Now that Bill Gates cuts the checks, we'll see if things continue as they have, or if they're going to try to find a business model that fits in with the Xbox playbook just a little bit better. All I know is that there are entire countries that are worth less than what they spent on that game. And that's kind of bonkers. January is a great time to check off some games from the old back catalog. Games that have been sitting on your hard drive for a while, or just ones that, you know, have caught your eyes in the past and you haven't gotten around to. This week I checked out a title that I'd heard the name before, but didn't really know anything about it. And that's The Exit 8. This game is interesting. It's very short. So in order to discuss it much at all, I kind of need to talk about the specifics. So I want to say, if you have any interest in checking this game out, and you want to go in with zero knowledge, which I think is the best way to do it, just go spend the $4 and play it now and then come back and listen to this episode. If you've already played it or you don't really plan on it, you can listen on. The concept is very simple. You're down in the tunnels of the Japanese metro system and you are trapped in a sort of loop. You go down a long hallway, make a couple of turns, and then you're somehow back at the beginning. The same signs on the wall, the same advertisements, the same man that you pass walking in the opposite direction each time. After repeating this several times, you're given your only instructions. In order to break the loop and find the exit, you need to look for anomalies in the hallway. If you spot something different about the environment, you need to turn around right away and go in the other direction. If nothing is different, if nothing's changed, you just keep going. If you do this correctly, you'll repeat the hallway again, but you'll notice a sign in the hallway signifying that you've moved on to the next level or round. Make it through 8 of these hallways correctly, and you'll find the exit. If you fail by missing a change and continuing forward, you reset to the beginning and do it all over again. And that's the game in a nutshell. The lack of any sort of narrative explanation combined with the quiet, sterile hallway makes for kind of a creepy vibe. It's a weird experience. There's nothing overtly scary, but it's just kind of unsettling. That sense of unease is enhanced by the fact that you never really know what form these anomalies will take. Some of them are subtle, like the fluorescent lights on the ceiling being slightly misaligned, or the handle on one of the maintenance doors that line the hall being in the wrong place. Just something minor. Other times, they're very obvious and very in your face, which can catch you off guard. Like how every time you turn the corner, the same man is always slowly walking towards you with his briefcase in one hand and his cell phone in the other. Except for the one time that you turn the corner and he is coming at you fast, almost sprinting towards you. Not cool, man. or the time when I was almost to the end of the hall before one of the doors, which never opened, by the way, they're all locked, decided to very slowly and very loudly creak open. And I'm not too proud to admit that I jumped when I heard that. That uncertainty of never knowing what's going to happen really had me on edge. The Exit 8 it's a cool project. It's neat. It's a neat idea that creates a creepy vibe and really doesn't take up, you know, too much of your time. You know, it's going to be a single evening. I finished my playthrough in about 15 minutes. You know, you can go back in and try to find all the different anomalies in the game. This is, you know, it's extremely short for a game, but at $4, it's really hard to be upset about that. If you like weird, experimental-type indie games, I think this one's easy to recommend. This week marks the first installment of a new segment where I'll be checking out retro games to see how they hold up today. I'm planning on running this segment probably about once a month, but it could be more often if people are into it, you know. So please let me know what you think. And this week's time capsule, we find Jumping Flash. Jumping Flash is a 1995 platformer co-developed by Exact and Ultra, and released for the original PlayStation. This was one of the very first games I remember playing for the PlayStation, and I never even had the full game. Back then, if you were like me and you had a game console, but not a lot of money, you played the heck out of the demo discs that came with a lot of the magazines back then. And I've got great memories of that demo. It was one of my earliest experiences with a full 3D world, and it was bright and colorful, and I played the heck out of it. So this game is available now on the PlayStation 5, either as part of their PlayStation Plus premium tier, which is $20 a month, or you can get it for $10 all on its own. And I gotta say, for a 30-year-old 3D platformer, it actually holds up pretty darn well. You play as Robit, a robotic bunny who needs to hop around these very vertically designed worlds, collecting carrots, which they call jet pods, and making it to the exit within the time limit. As you search for the carrots, you'll take on enemies by shooting them or hopping on top of them, or you use special weapons that you find around the environment, like rockets or acorn grenades. What makes the game unique to me is the way that you traverse the world. The game is played in first-person perspective, and you have the ability to do a triple jump to make your way around and find all the items, which are usually pretty high up on the platforms. What's interesting is that you're facing forward when you're walking around or when you jump, but once you hit that double jump while you're in the midair, your perspective will switch to a top-down view, which allows you to watch your shadow and aim your landing on the platforms as you hop about. It's pretty neat, and it works well. The only downside is that you don't have the option to freely look around all over the world. So if you're high up on a ledge, you can't just, like, you know, use the analog stick to peer down over the side to look for your next objective. You need to do that double jump again and try to see what you're looking for as the camera, you know, switches perspectives and pans down. It's, you know, it's slightly annoying, but doesn't kill the fun. You got to remember that when the PS1 came out, there were no analog sticks. It was just the D-pad. So the game's pretty short, but I'm fine with that. There are 6 worlds with 3 levels each, and one of those levels being a boss fight, which, you know, they're pretty good. They're simple, but they're fun. There's good fun to be had here for, like, a, you know, a weekend of retro gaming. I'd say if you have that premium account, it's definitely worth a play. And if you're curious about the early PlayStation days, $10 is a pretty reasonable price for what you get. Thank you so much for listening to Midlife Side Quest. I appreciate you making time in your day to hang out with me. You can catch new episodes of the show Thursday mornings wherever you listen to podcasts, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and YouTube. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a review while you're there. Also, if you have a question or comment, you can leave me a voicemail at speakpipe.com/sidequest. And you can find me on Blue Sky, which seems to be the last social media platform that doesn't encourage hate speech and isn't run by fascists. So find me there. And until next time, be well and happy gaming.